Hello, hello, and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Good Areas Live. I'm Behram Kazi, who you can find at Def Mango. And with me, I've got Jared Kimber, who you can find literally everywhere. And Jared, South Africa are test champions. They've won their first ICC trophy since that inaugural Champions Trophy back in 1998, which no one cares about or remembers. And they got there by chasing down 282.
That's not the best way of saying it. You've said it the wrong way.
What's the best
They've
way of saying it?
They've won their first world trophy.
Yeah,
right?
Fair.
This is what
there
it is.
Go.
They've won their first World Cup. I don't know why everyone keeps tying themselves in knots about the Champions. Champions Trophy is a secondary trophy. It's not the main trophy. No one thinks of anyone who's won it as the world champions, right? They have won their first ever world title.
True, and they got there by chasing down 282 runs versus defending champions Australia, who were odds-on favourites by a lot. 75% winning odds were in favour of Australia. And yeah, to win that game by 5 wickets, which was also the second highest successful chase in the history of Lords after the West Indies in the 80s, where they were 344 for one by the end of it. I mean, what a true underdog story, Jared. It is massive for South Africa. And by the way, congratulations to all South African fans. Today, we're all South African because cricket has healed. This is what cricket needed. This is what the sport needed. And honestly, Jared, I don't know about you, but this felt really personal to me. I'm not South African, but as a cricket media professional, these are the moments we live for. These are the arcs that we live for.
Yeah, no, it was really special to be in the ground. Yesterday, I basically thought the game was going to be over yesterday, and I was doing stuff the night before the game, and all 3 nights of the game I was out, and was really, really tired. I was like, oh my God, I'm going to have to come back for an hour. And I'm thinking, is it worth it? Like, I'm my own boss. I don't have to come back if I don't want to, right? Like, I can make a decision. And then I was like, but if South Africa win, or even if South Africa don't win, I could miss this incredible thing. I'm really glad I went back. It was very special. I would say that there were two different sort of special feelings. There was the night before, which was really interesting. There was almost more partying the night before. Right? And I think part of that was, it was a crap first session. So South Africans probably started drinking early, right? Like they're like, they're starting to think we're going to lose. Then, you know, they lose that early wicket as well. And then obviously it just gets better and better from there. So it was a real sort of drunken party, right? There. Yeah. Whereas this bit was more like the bit just after a wedding when everyone's just sort of buzzing, right? When, you know, they're not even, I remember looking over at the fans at one stage and they didn't know what to do. Right. Whereas the night before, that wasn't the case, right? Everyone was partying and screaming and everything. And it was like they didn't know what to do with the win. So look, for me,
they wouldn't know what to do because they've never won a major title before. Honestly, like, I saw Keshav Maharaj tearing up. He could barely speak. And you get that. That's what it means to him. Dude, I fucking nearly teared up. And I saw your tweet as well. You were clearly feeling it at Lords.
Yeah, no, I was. It's, you know, I've been lucky enough to see some incredible things. I think the West Indies winning two titles on the one day is, you know, obviously one of the most incredible things I've seen. And, you know, some of the test matches, that I've been able to go to in the 2019 World Cup and the 2017 Women's World Cup, all these different things. But it's right at the top. You know, I've been really lucky to think the last couple of weeks, it's been like a celebration of Southern African cricket, right? Yeah. In the UK. And it felt great having Zimbabwe back home and the way that their fans just completely took to it. And I don't have any of those kinds of emotions with South Africa. I've never, you know, they've never been like my second favorite team or my third favorite team. I don't think I own a South African cricket shirt. I think the closest I would have is a Marizan Van Cap t-shirt. And yet, like, when it happened, I even got a message from an Aussie mate who just said to me, I'm actually kind of glad that it's just, that they've done it and they all would get to feel, you know, that. So I think even Australians would know. There's a really fascinating one in the Mound Stand where there was heaps of South Africans and they went nuts when they won, obviously. And I looked over and I was watching it and there was this Australian fan in front. He had like a Geelong jumper on and he realizes that they've lost and he turns around, he gets his phone out and he just films the fans. And that's not something you always see in a sporting event, right? You're generally disappointed, you're frustrated. I remember I was talking to David Fleming after the game, and he was like, Jared, what are we going to do about our batting? Whatever. Like, that's the normal reaction. Whereas this guy, because he was in that group of South Africans, I think he realized it just meant more to them than it does. And look, I don't want to have a go at Australian fans because Australian fans have been wonderful over a long time. But there isn't that same outletting of emotion for Australian fans that you get that you got in a game like this, just because Australian fans are just so used to winning. And as you said, the South Africans weren't. So it was magical to be there. I watched them do the full lap of honor around the ground. I went up and recorded my video, and then I sort of walked back amongst them in the nursery stand. And there were just so many great moments. Like, I remember seeing this woman just run across, right, to the other side. And it was because she saw this random person. And it reminded me of what the players had done. The players were walking around the inside, right? So they didn't do what Zimbabweans did. They didn't jump the stands or anything. Mm. But they walk around the inside. But then at every 10 meters, a player would see someone they recognized, right? They knew so many people. And it's just not something you get with other cricket cultures. And I don't know how to fully explain that to everyone. But, you know, there is something about that sort of Southern African cricket culture, which you know, and the way that they go about it. And it was a really special moment. And I haven't even mentioned the sort of the Themba Bavuma-ness of it, right? There was something cool about his teammates taking a step back and letting him. He's got one hand around his kid. Kid's got his cap on. He's got the other hand with the mace. And there was a thought of like, maybe the other players want to hold the mace. And I look back and they were all just happily following it, right? There was no one was waiting for their turn or anything like that. And, you know, I wrote the story yesterday about what it was like to be in St. John's Wood tube station.
Yeah.
And they were the drunken fans, it was completely full. And it wasn't just they were chanting his name, it was echoing. And it was like the only other time I felt like that for South African cricket was when I was in the Wanderers during, might have even been an ODI, I can't remember, but it was I remember being at the Wanderers and thinking, oh, this is the future of South African cricket, because every race was there, they were singing, they were enjoying it together. Like, it was just a beautiful moment to be. This is the one that is the closest to that for me.
Honestly, my heart was so full when I saw Themba lift that mace. And there's so much context to this. This is a black South African captain in a country which has been marred by racism. They were exiled from cricket and they only got readmitted in 1992. As you mentioned in your piece, he's been doubted, he's been mocked, he's been fat shamed by everyone, left, right and center, even by his own countrymen. And he goes on to become the breaker of hoodoos by exercising the ghosts of knockouts past, right? 12 semi-finals, 2 quarter-finals, and 1 T20 World Cup final as well. This guy is unbeaten as captain in Test cricket, Jared. 9 wins, 1 draw, and he's averaged 59.25 with the bat in this cycle of the World Test Championship final. And most importantly, he's gotten rid of the C word. The C word has been replaced by champions, and now people will think twice before using that term, which they used to use so loosely. And we've talked about this so much.
Yeah, it was really interesting, actually. I was kind of thinking about his entire journey of, they set him up to fail a little bit, cricket South Africa, and they did it for the right reasons, right? Like, they really did do it for the right reasons. They knew he was talented, right? And I remember talking to some coaches, and let's say these are less reconstructed coaches than other people, and they were like, look, he can bat. Like, we don't think he's not in the best 7 or 8 batters in our country. But what they kept saying was they keep giving him a really easy position to bat in Test cricket, and they won't even give some other kids a go. He clearly was the captain of a T20 side. When is he in the best 40 T20 players in his own country? Like, no, let's be honest, that was bad. He probably wasn't. The one day game, I remember writing about this in 2019 going, he's probably a one day player. And it took them forever to get him into the one day side of all things that he was completely suited to. So if you were starting again with Themba, I think what you do is you get him into one day cricket. Maybe you bat him at 5 or 4 to start with, and you just like knock around the spinners, run really hard, and be the best fielder out there, right? Then when you get used to that, we'll get you into the Test team. But he's like, he can bat number 4 in Test cricket. Like, he's not a strong number 4, although you know he's been batting really well recently. He can bat at number 4, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's just how different things are and how much things have changed with him. And
Jared, he has the weight of the world on his shoulders with all of those expectations that he will end the drought. And, you know, so Australia were firm favourites before the final with that 75% chance. They had a first innings lead of 74. I think that's when their odds must have been the highest, right? Given the way the surface was behaving. There were so many moments where they were ahead in this Test match.
I once made a pair in a club game, which is almost impossible to do. But I have been obsessed with batting my entire life. And so I put that into my new book, The Art of Batting. Being that I'm not very good at that skill, I decided to talk to other people who were. So I hit up as many contacts as I could just to talk about batting. Rahul Dravid, Brian Lara, AB de Villiers, Kumar Sangakkara, Ross Taylor, Susie Bates, Nasser Hussain, Ian Chappell, and so many, many, many more. I wanted batters to talk about how they and their friends made runs, because that is the art of batting. Yeah, I can't remember when their odds were at the highest. There was a couple of times when Australia was just massively in front. I think when they were, 35 for 4 or whatever it was at Stumpton Day 1, that was Australia was so, were basically unbackable at that stage. So they probably had like a 90, 92% chance. I'd have to go back and check the odds. But that was my memory of that. Then you had, when Australia was, 28 without loss? In the second innings. Does that sound right? Mm-hmm. Is that what they got to? Do you remember? In the second innings?
I can't
innings
remember that bit, no.
Yeah, so again, they were massively ahead in the game. And then, of course, the Hazelwood-Stark partnership, right?
Yes.
Where, again, you had a situation where you were like, I just remember, I want to say when they came together, it was about even. So about 50% each, right? Because the draw was gone. Draw had 0%, obviously.
Yeah.
So about 50% each. And I would have said that Australia would have come into 80-85% chance of winning.
Yeah.
And when when Rickleton went out, I would assume it was even more. So there were so many times they were out of that game entirely. And yet, you know,
it's
they have come back.
It's basically the anti-choke, right?
What's the biggest problem they have doing?
Well, they struggle when they bat, right? This testing.
When they chase.
Yes, then they chase, exactly. And they go on to chase 282, which is a tough score on any sort of surface. And I know the conditions ease out, right? Sure. But, you know, there's so many people who are throwing shade at, or have been throwing shade at, their road to the final because they haven't played a lot of top teams. But then again, they don't decide their draw. They threw away one series versus New Zealand.
Yep.
And this was also a full circle moment because in 99, they lose to Australia in that semi-final in England. And that's the team who they beat in 2025. So it's just brilliant. It's a wonderful arc.
There is something about the fact that it kind of had to be Australia, right?
Yeah.
Like that if it was anyone, let's say, I'm trying to think, if New Zealand had got in, right? Or Sri Lanka, you know, if one of those teams had got in and they'd won, we'd all be like, yeah, but they also won a Commonwealth Games and a Champions Trophy.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, they didn't beat the best team. It's hard to argue that Australia's been the best team in the entire thing. And hard to argue that Australia were massively in front in this game at times. Like, Australia looked like the better side between the two. And
Australia had holes in this cycle, but they were the best team in this cycle up until
the
final.
On paper. Even in the final, they were the better team, right?
And been there before. They have won it before. They were experienced. They were pedigreed.
Mate,
everything was in their favor.
This game went 3 days in one session, right? Australia dominated 2 days in one session.
Yeah.
Right, they were in front of the game pretty much. Even when South Africa took early wickets, Australia weren't behind in the game. Right, like they probably there was a little flint when Bavuma was batting quite well on the morning of day two, where you're like, oh, maybe it's getting close to even money again. But other than that, you know, like Australia were in front, so I think that's huge. It's an interesting one for Australia going ahead, just from the perspective of I think they just kind of expected to win this. But let's just get back to the chase for a moment. Like, the pitch flattened out, but it wasn't a road, right?
There was no bounce. The ball was turning square out of the rough, right?
Yeah, there was consistent low bounce, I would say, as well. There probably wasn't enough balls that were low enough on the stumps to cause problems. But all you need is one of those. There was one off the stumps that easily, you know, like bunches of them off the stumps that kept quite low. There was one that bounced like meters in front of Carey. And that's the one that you inside edge back onto leg stump on the bad day, right? As you said, the ones exploding out of the footmarks. Again, one of those. How often would Lyon bowl on a wicket like that, getting that kind of spin that he got, without getting a wicket? Like, it's pretty unlikely. You know, they had the drop catch as well, where they did everything right, Australia, with that. They knew the catchers weren't carrying, so they moved Smith up, and that's the one that almost kills him. Like, we had him and Marco Jansen almost die in this game because the teams did the right thing, and suddenly they almost got their heads taken off. So
it's crazy how
it's
so
not
many,
like it was just a normal flat wicket.
There were a million catches, by the way, that didn't carry to slips, and then those two guys come up and Jansen drops Stark on 14. He goes back unbeaten on 58, and then Steve Smith drops Temba Bavuma on 2 on June 13th, which is an amazing parallel because Herschel Gibbs drops Steve Waugh on June 13th back in 99, which was a Reddit post, and I love that little parallel as well. But overall, you'd have to say it was an important toss to win by Temba, who did obviously opt to field first looking at the overcast skies. And I was afraid initially. I was like, hey, Zimbabwe did the same thing, and then Trent Bridge was, you know, a road, and you had mentioned how the conditions are dry, but then South Africa get the best of the bowling and the batting conditions, so they win a very important toss. And also just the conditions, I love these sort of conditions for test cricket. You've got overcast skies for 2 days, the ball is, you know, getting a lot of deviation off the surface, there was lateral movement from ball one, there were three maidens in a row at the start of the test match, right? The degrees of seam were worse or more in the first innings compared to the second innings, so they get those better conditions. And then ultimately the sun bakes the surface on day three, and whilst it's not an out and out road because of the low bounce at the nursery end and the balls turning square out of the rough, it's still the best batting conditions throughout the test match. So I mean, the toss gods were smiling on Temba.
I think they actually got the best batting conditions twice, right? The start of day two and probably the end of day three. I don't think it was quite as easy today, but they certainly got them. Look, I thought they had to win the toss because I think if they hadn't, Australia would have bowled them out for 150. And I just don't think that South Africa would have been able to keep enough pressure on them at that stage to be able to keep them back in the game. Now, it turned out that they won the toss and Smith got away from them a little bit. And so it's still, you know, is arguably, and, you know, they're in a position where it could have got away from them and everything else. But, you know, the wicket, Aidan Markram's wicket of Smith is one of the flukiest wickets I've ever seen in cricket. And it's probably the difference between winning and losing this game when we go back on it. Because if not, maybe Australia make 250. It's just too many, right? And, you know, it could have been more than 250 because it's Smith, right? So it was huge. But, yeah, no, I always thought they had to win the toss. But they didn't win the game the way I thought they'd win it. Mm. The way I thought they'd win it would be to roll Australia for about 150, 160. Mm. I think I said, I can't remember who I was talking to. It might have been Fidos. But I was. She was like, what do you think? And I said, once they get past 180, it's tough. Mm. And that turned out to be true, right? Because South Africa didn't get anywhere near 180. So I was right there. But the thing that really changed everything was that I thought once Australia got the 50-60 run lead, right? Second innings, I still thought they'd lose wickets, but I thought they'd get a couple of cheap runs and they'd get ahead. Yeah. They just never got ahead. And the truth of this is that South Africa's bowling was, you know, kept them in this cycle all the way through. Yeah. And it kind of got them back into this game and then on the morning of day three, back out of it again for a little while as well. But generally, you know, that was the incredible thing about South Africa, right? Was this, you know, that their bowling always kept them in the game. And, you know, we'll talk about this chase for a long time to come. Mm. They're in the World Test Championship final and they had a chance of chasing 280 because of their bowling lineup.
And the game ebbed and flowed perfectly. Like, it was a spectacle for all neutral viewers. And I'm sure people who are supporting Australia as well would have enjoyed it. Like, look, South Africa won the first session. Australia were 4 down for 67. Then Australia score 123 runs for the loss of one wicket. And they're 190 for 5. Then they come back and they're bowled out for 212. Like, it was just going back and forth, back and forth. And even in the third innings, they're 73 for 7. You're like, oh, South Africa are in with a shot. And they end up making 207, right? Now, two really important moments over here. Bo Webster is out LBW on 8 and Themba Bavuma and South Africa do not review. He goes on to score 72, right? And then Stark is dropped in the third innings on 14. He goes out or walks off unbeaten on 58. If you combine those runs, that's like over 120 runs or so, right? Despite that, South Africa win it and so convincingly, which is just marvelous. I mean, I'm a fan. Take my money.
No, exactly. And look, as I said, it just wouldn't have meant as much as if Australia had won it. There was more South Africans there. I think Neil Manthorpe had written a story about how cricket of South Africa had brought some of their staff in. You know, it was a big deal. The ICC media manager, Isipha Kazi, she's a former, Cricket South Africa employee. A lot of the camera crew, South Africa. I know it's weird things, but, you know, obviously Graham Smith and Sean Pollock were around. I saw Barry Richards on one day, Hashim Amla on another day. Right?
It's so just, many legends, right? And you know
what?
It didn't
really
feel
like an Australian game and sometimes it does. But the Australians didn't get as excited about this as the South Africans did.
And as you mentioned, all of those legends, right? Like Smith, Amla, Barry Richards, Sean Pollock, AB, who just won with RCB as a fan, right? And he's had a brilliant 2 weeks because RCB and South Africa both win and end their droughts. And, you know, there have been so many supreme South African teams over the years and some legendary players. And this inexperienced team is the one that goes on to lift that coveted ICC trophy. It's just straight out of a fairy tale, man. Like, I don't have words.
No, exactly. And also, if it was a T20 World Cup, I don't want to say that we would have said they had fluked it, but there is an element of it's very hard to, you can get on a bit of a roll, or like Australia in, was it 2021 when the tosses go your way, or, you know, and we've seen teams do this in limited overs games before. Hmm. I think when you're playing Australia and you've got, you know, Khawaja and Smith and Head, and then you've got, you know, the bowling attack and everything that you've got there, and you keep getting behind in the game, there are so many chances for South Africa just to be like, not going to happen. As you said, the Marco Jansen catch is a very, very good example of that. The whole Stark-Hazelwood partnership, right? We are Mulder batting really well and just spooning the ball straight to cover. You know, all these little things.
Both, actually. I would say both partnerships. Carey and Stark at 61 and then Hazelwood and Stark at 59 for the last wicket. That is soul-sapping. That would demoralize the best in the business.
But there's heaps of those moments when you go back through, like Bavuma getting the one that nipped away early on. And you're like, or maybe there is moisture in the wicket, and you know they could second guess themselves and everything else. So I just think when you know there will always be people who go, oh, they got into the thing because they didn't play hard teams. Oh, boo hoo! The big three forgot to set up a tournament that actually benefits themselves for once. These things are going to happen, right? You have to get over it. But they had to beat Australia on a pitch that probably helped South Africa because it was such a low scoring pitch. But I think even within that, it wasn't like the sort of wicket that I thought. If it was an absolute green seamer, right? And it was and it was nipping around violent the whole way, South Africa could win that. We saw South Africa win a test in baseball during that, right?
True.
But when it was this kind of wicket where I was like, actually what you need to do here is bowl really well, but then it gives you help. Maybe that's more suited to the Australian bowling lineup. Especially, this wasn't even, like a lot of people have said to me, this wasn't even South Africa's best team ever. And it's like, obviously not. But it's not even their best team that they could have picked. Like, I think they actually still made selection mistakes within this.
I think both teams did, honestly. I wasn't a fan of the whole experiment with opening with Marnus and then having Cam Green at number three. And then similarly for South Africa, they took a gamble with Mulder at three and didn't play Patterson. All the things that we didn't even expect, right? And in hindsight, you could say maybe Scotty Boland should have played ahead of Lyon, but then given the conditions, that doesn't make sense, right? And Australia bowled exceptionally well in their first bowling inning. So there's so many ifs and buts and things that you can say in hindsight over here, but I think that both teams gambled quite a bit with selection.
No, definitely. Why don't we take a break, and then after the break, we'll talk some more.
Absolutely. So go nowhere where you're watching Good Areas Live with Jared and Bahram, and we'll be back in like half a minute.
I have travelled the cricketing world, and so I've collected two things: the phone numbers of random taxi drivers and overseas SIM cards. Rideshare apps have fixed the first part, and Sally is doing the second. Now, all you need is their eSIM on whatever plan works for you. You activate it, and you can use it anywhere in the cricketing world. It helps you save money. It is a global solution to a global problem. Stop fiddling with tiny sims and get the one that does it all. Go to Sally.com Good Areas and use the code Good Areas to get an exclusive 15% off your first purchase. Fly free with Sally.
Welcome back to Good Areas Live. You guys are with Bahram and Jared, and we're discussing the World Test Championship final, which South Africa won by 5 wickets. Now, I think we really need to talk about the fielding over here because it was absolutely exceptional in the first innings. Some of the best fielding I've seen in my life. Spotless, unmistakable South Africa. And Markram in the slips was amazing. Virena with that catch down the leg side versus head, right? Ground fielding was also awesome with Demba throwing himself around. And the field placement was exceptional, right? In that innings, which we didn't really see throughout the rest of the match because a million catches fell short of the slips and the keeper. But then again, Smith and Jansen came up forward, dropped those catches. Smith got his pinky destroyed. Alex Carey weirdly dropped a sitter as well, but that was it, right? Marnus was a live wire in the field for Australia. Bo Webster took that phenomenal catch. And then also Travis Head towards the end. So weirdly enough, we got a great fielding game.
Yeah, no, there was a lot going on there, wasn't there? I talked about the fluky wicket of Markram and Smith before. The one thing I would say that was not fluky about that was the fielding from Bavuma just beforehand when he came, when Smith was trying to get off strike and Bavuma stops the single, right? And most fielders in the world cricket, that's just the single. It's just it's getting past him, and Bavuma manages to keep him on strike. And as you said, there were some great catches. I had no problems with the field. There was some fascinating fielding. I mean, I don't want to get too caught up in the fact that we invented short first slip, but also there was like a catching deep extra cover for Bavuma when he first came in as well. There was some fascinating things. Australia went to an umbrella field at one stage. I think they had five guys in a line.
They had a short off, remember?
Yeah, so there was quite a few different, things that we saw within there. But I think fielding played a big part. And if you're not the better side, right, that's also part of it. Like that, I'm not saying they had to be perfect because they weren't perfect, right? Yeah. But you have to keep pulling back over and over again little bits. And I didn't think Bavuma was very good tactically. Like if you go back to day one, there was a big period when I think Smith was batting and he was just bowling Vian Mulder and Ngidi back to back. I think I'm right if I remember that, for ages. And if you go the next day, Cummins is like, Cummins doesn't bring Webster on, right? Cummins is like, no, I could bring Webster on and he might be handy here, but we're going to keep bowling our main bowlers until we get a wicket here. So, you know, little things like that. Bavuma still made mistakes, but they made up for it in so many different things all the way through.
So with respect to Bavuma, if I look at his captaincy, of course, there's that Bo Webster non-review, but they would have thought there's an inside edge over there. I also felt that he used Kagiso Rabada a touch conservatively at times, right? But that also might be a fitness thing.
Robotically is the way I would say. I'm not. Was it a fitness thing? Because he's making bold, big spells. Jeremy Coney was there all game. He was commentating for SCN, and he just kept coming up to me and goes, "Does he know that he doesn't have to bowl seven overs straight after a break?"
That's right? Also like, true.
Why would you not bowling for four overs? Take him out, give him a little rest. Like, if it's seven overs a session, he has to bowl, which is I think what Jeremy was suggesting. I didn't look at the mass, but if that's the case, why just bowl them in one big block? Right? Even I tell you what. By the end of the game, Rabada did not look very fit. When he was bowling that spell to Stark and Hazelwood, because he got line out, and I think that was a bit of a lucky wicket. He was bowling at like 82 miles an hour, 81 miles an hour. He looked like you out there, mate, not like Kagiso Rabada. Like, he was struggling.
I have a question. Do you think that South Africa didn't bowl short enough to Mitch Stark?
I just think by that stage, the pitcher died. If you ever look, how many bounces did Australia try? Right? Like they went, they had the field.
Pat Cummins was good with bounces, right?
How often did the ball get above the head height?
That's also true.
Or shoulder height.
They were showing on the broadcast that versus the short stuff, batting average at Lords is around 22 runs per wicket, which is the lowest in England. So I don't know.
Yeah, but that's when the ball bounces. It wasn't bouncing. Stark, at one stage, they tried to bowl short with Stark and didn't get up. Marco Jansen tried to bowl a short spell and the ball didn't get up. Like, I'm sorry, if Marco Jansen can't do it, I think that's on the surface. So Stark's a little bit different than those two guys, but I wouldn't say that it was like Stark bowled a ball at one stage, and I can't remember when this was, but the ball just got stuck in his hand, and it should have looped up in the air, and in the end it just sort of died. I think it went to Bettingham. There wasn't much in that wicket when it comes to bounce, so I think both teams flirted with short balls and it didn't really work, especially probably after halfway through day two.
Honestly, I think Cummins did make a few more flaws than Temba, especially when Markram and Temba were batting in the fourth innings and they string up that match-winning partnership of 147 runs. I even messaged this in the group. There were three fielders, square of the wicket, and they were deep. One on the offside and two on the leg side, or I might have mixed that up. But, you know, you're offering easy singles to both of those guys when you're bowling a good length.
Temba did that all game. What are you talking about? Temba had the exact same field, so how can he ever go at Cummins? That's just modern cricket, mate. You're now moaning about clouds. Cummins cycled through. I didn't keep it all in my notes, but I reckon Cummins cycled through about 14 or 15 distinct plans, which if that was Stokes, we would have said, captain genius, look at him. He's changing things quite regularly. Cummins doesn't do it quite as quick, but I actually thought they tried quite a few things. I'm not sure. I think if you play that innings back 100 times, Lyon just gets 2 or 3 wickets. Right, I think if you just play that innings back, the average wickets he probably gets in that is probably 2.7, right? And probably you get one more wicket from either a drag on or a ball that keeps low. If you look at them, they ended up at 5 wickets down. So if you'd got them 6, 7, 8 wickets down earlier in the game, then most probably Australia win. I wasn't sitting there saying that was a Pat Cummins disaster class. In the same way that I looked at data of South Africa when Stark and Hazelwood were batting, and I was like, I think they're doing the right thing. It's just not working. So I think we have to be, I think we have to remember that if you can't go through Stark and Hazelwood, there is a chance that top class players still do well. Having said that, Aidan Markram, he's probably played two great test innings in his life. and he's going to end up averaging about 30 odd.
It's a good area's joke, isn't it? That he has this one world-class knock every year and that happens to come in a final where he was on a pair, was dismissed for a duck in the first innings and then scores 136 in the fourth. And I mean, player of the match, deservedly so. He scores a fourth innings 100. Out of his 800s, 3 are fourth innings 100. So he is second on the list for South Africa behind Graham Smith. And 3 of his 800s come versus Australia, who he averages 61.6 versus with the bat. He's etched his name on the Lord's Honours board. And I mean, it was an all-timer knock, even if the conditions at ease for batting, right? And it came at the perfect time for South Africa. What I loved was the muted, almost unnoticeable and iced cold celebrations, which, you know, he delivered after he scored 100. He had the face of a man who was basically echoing the sentiment that, hey, my job's not done here yet. I still have to win this test match for South Africa.
No, exactly. And I think you're right. There was certainly an element there of he knew he had more to come. I mean, I've written quite a bit about what happened when he went out as well. Like, I think he was just almost in shock, right, that he was taken from the crew. Honestly, I think I said in it that at one stage I was like, someone's going to have to get him off the ground. Like, he's taking so long. Yeah. Like, you know, and I've seen
he
that
before. He got a standing ovation, though. That's the only plus point of him getting out.
He didn't notice the standing ovation for the longest time. I promise you, he was so down. Yeah. And I'm glad that within the last 20 meters or so, he sort of realized what was happening around him and came back. But yeah, it was a real shame he went out. Mel Jones was running behind me, and I could tell she came down the stairs and missed it. And I went, Mel, he's out. And she just went, no. Now, this is an Australian, right? So even she's like, no, if we're going to win, we want, you know, we want Markram there to the end. And I felt the same when Bavuma went out as well, where I was just like, it's so Bavuma, isn't it, to not like be there at the end and not get the credit when he's actually played a couple of really important knocks throughout this game. So
really, really good knocks, right?
With Markram, I just thought it was great. Look, I have said this for a very long time. I know some of the technical reasons that Markram has issues. And, you know, I've certainly covered that in limited overs cricket quite a bit. Hmm. But when I saw him at 20 or 21, whenever it was the first time I really watched him, I was like, my God, they've got another one. He's going to average 50 in test cricket and he's going to be outstanding. He hasn't worked out how to be that person. And he might never work out how to be that person. But he's because of this innings. And I'll throw the one in at Cape Town as well, because that was a remarkable knock as well.
The India one, but
because
right?
The India one. So because of these innings, I just think you have, at a certain point, you just have to say to yourself, like, I hope he's just built enough for people to remember him. That's all he needs. Because it would be a real shame if he's not remembered.
He's a KL Rahul-esque player in Test cricket, such that he hasn't really lived up to his potential. But honestly, like, he's played an all-time knock. I was devastated when he was out 6 runs shy of creating history.
You and Mel Jones.
Eventually. Yeah, me and Mel Jones. And, you know, not only has he scored the most runs in the World Test Championship final and looked like great at it while he did that, his running between the wickets was insane. And Demba, have to give him more credit because he was hobbling. And then phenomenal catching in the slips. He got 2 wickets as well. I'm just such a big fan of his punchy offside play and the square drive down on one knee, the cut shots, the late cuts versus pace, right? Such a great late cut versus Stark. And then he pulled the ball. He flicked the ball off his legs and hips. And he was edgy at times, but it was a chance to stalk. And he was the deserving player of the match at the end of the day, right? But if you look at South Africa's batting in the first innings, a lot of people had an issue with their scoring rate because at the end of day one, they were 43 for 4 in 22 overs. So less than 2 runs per over, not taking a lot of chances. And they had a good first session, day two. They scored 78 for one.
We should just say, just to pause there, that we played a blinder, you and I, in our chat. Do you remember? You said they'll be 47 for 4. And I said, I don't think they'll get to 47. Right, so you were like 4 runs off, but I was also right that like 47, I'm not sure they'll be able to score that many. You were saying.
Honestly, I also played a blinder in the chat when I said my least favorite overs are the Lungi and Ngidi overs, and then he goes on to wrap Smith and Bo Webster on the pads, LBW.
I mean, to be fair, he bowled like a busted ass in the first inning, didn't he? He looked like they had definitely made a mistake, and good on him for bringing it back in the second innings. In fact, they probably bowled him a little bit too long. I think if he'd finished after maybe when it was that he got Carey, Cummins out, I would have taken him straight off, and that's when I would have brought on Rabada or Jansen. And they left him and Mulder on. I was like, they've done their job. They're now tired. Yeah. Get them off and get the other guys back on. And if that doesn't work, you can chop and change again.
I remember the conversation with CS where we were like, they should have played Patterson, and then who are all the other candidates? Kyle Abbott, Gerald Coetzee, Nokia. Duan Olivier's name came up, for fuck's sake. Nandre Berger, right? Everyone. We discussed everyone, and then Ngidi goes on to
Steve Elworthy.
Yeah, and 3 for 38 after none for 45 in 8 overs in the first innings, where he was basically unbowlable. So that's big. And I loved how South Africa actually, you know, they conquered the timid approach within the same game, right? Sure, they after being 121 for 5, they were rolled over for 138. But when they came out to bat in the fourth innings, they batted with a lot of intent. They picked up the singles, rotated strike, and they hit the bad balls for 4. And that was the way to go. And I suppose we have to talk a bit about Demba, right? 102 runs in the test match, 36 in the first inning, 66 in the second. He was hobbling, dropped on Smith, cashed in, and got off the mark off the 31st delivery in the first innings. Some brilliant shots throughout those two innings. The lofted cover and square drives, the grounded cover drive, the pull for 6, and then the weird spin stuff. Conventional sweeps, log sweep, which really nearly goes to Constance. Edges one nearly to the slip fielder versus spin. Flick, pull, there was a straight drive, the flick. It was just, Demba deserves this. He has literally silenced critics left, right, and center. And now he has etched his name in history. No one can put any disrespect on my man Demba's name.
Look, it's you know, you talked about it a little bit in the opening, but let's finish off here. It's an important thing that cricket in South Africa is for everyone, right? Yeah. And, you know, when you look at what the rugby team has managed to do over the last little while, the football team, who aren't as successful, right? And they have managed to do. And as I went there in 2003, and I went into a country that was clearly divided. And I'm not saying it's not divided now, as Donald Trump is trying to exploit at the moment. But there's, it feels like to me that there is genuine things moving forward, right? And that there, you know, there are opportunities for people. There's structural issues, right, that aren't going away. Like the young black kids specifically really find it hard to get into the very nice schools, which is where all the great facilities are, which is where like 90% of South Africa's cricketers have come from, right? Like it is hard. There's, you know, no one's ever going to pretend that that isn't the case. But you need moments, right? And, you know, if you go back to the 2015 World Cup, and, you know, and we know that Vernon Philander was asked to play when he wasn't fully fit. And, you know, I know Kyle Abbott's talked about this before, you know, and people try and play it down, but there was certainly a sense at the time that they wanted, you know, a certain amount of players who were not white to play in that game. And my theory at the time hasn't changed. I think representation matters. I think the problems are structural at the bottom level, not at the top level. But my issue at the time was, if they picked a fully, you know, a great team in that World Cup, and they'd managed to go on and play the way that they should have and won, would it have mattered if there was one fewer non-white face in the side, right?
And I think also to flip the story, Jared, I know that you're making a very important point, but David Beddingham is a Coldpack player in essence. He plays for Durham, right? And he also plays an important knock, or two important knocks, 45 in the first innings where he's top scorer for them, then unbeaten on 21 when it gets a bit nervy when Stubbs gets out. And whilst he got squared up a lot on his back foot, right, when the ball was pitched at a good length, his front foot play was amazing. Off his legs, down the ground, a scintillating cover drive. He's also an important story, and he's like the anti-Temba in this entire situation.
Yeah. So, like, that was my point back then was, isn't it better to win and inspire people that way? And not try and force it in. And I understand the representation matters, because I know that Giannis Antetokounmpo watched a basketball game and Greece won, and there was a person with his color skin out there. Like, I understand how it matters. Like, you know, my wife tells me stories like that of, you know, just simple things, right? You know, being able to do that, having Moana as one of the Disney princesses, all these things matter, right? In inspiring future generations. But this wasn't. Temba Bavuma is not in the side right now because of the color of his skin. He's not leading the side because of the color of his skin. He's there because he's a really experienced player, a fighter, as you said before. He's more than earned his spot as a test match batter, especially in this cycle of all the cycles, right?
Yes.
And so this just means 100 times more, right, to South Africa, the cricket culture, but more importantly, outside of that, South Africa, the nation. This isn't going to mean that it's easy for young kids, poorer areas of South Africa to play for the national team, right?
Yeah.
But it might mean that not every kid gravitates towards rugby or football automatically, right? And you know, there's never been a time in South Africa where cricket has been a national sport, not the national sport. Yeah. That's a separate argument, but a national sport. It's always been siloed. It was siloed by the white English, right? Then after readmission, it was, you know, the white English, a little bit of Asia, and a little bit of the Afrikaans came in. Then the whole posh thing happens, and it's about where you came from and, you know, what background you had, you know, whether it be race, whether it be class. And we even had the issue with their women's team dropping off for quite a long time. It's always been segmented in different ways, right? South African cricket. Being in that ground with the people, right, and hanging out with them, and as I said, having been at the Wanderers and had a similar feeling, it's like, it just feels like it's going in the right direction. A million things can stop it from that, right? But it just feels that it's going in the right direction, and that's why it was such a magical thing to be there. It's not just magical from a cricket perspective. There is something about South Africa that is incredibly important to cricket, but also has this very dark past and this gloomy past and all the worst parts of cricket as well. You know, bringing the empire into it when they didn't need to, right? Refusing to play the non-white teams and everything else. And then they become this laughingstock. And there's something about them being able to get beyond that, because it's a special cricket country, and it always has been, right? And we want the entire country to be special, not just the bits that happen to go to the right schools or have the right kind of families.
Yeah. Anyway, we've spoken about the batting and, of course, the cultural context of it all with respect to South Africa. And there are a lot of comments that are saying KG, KG, KG. But we'll come to him after a short break. You guys are watching Good Areas Live with Behram and Jared, and we'll be back in like half a minute.
Brian Lara used pot plants to work on his placement. John Wright glued his glove to his bat. Sachin Tendulkar dug up practice pitches. Tatenda Taibu cut the top off his bat. Claire Taylor used a hockey grip. Steve Smith was from tennis. Dean Jones would call phantom runs. And Victor Trumper turned the Nets into a war zone to survive. The best batters in the world do whatever they have to make runs. We have told their stories in our new book, The Art of Batting.
All right, welcome back to Good Areas Live, and we don't have a lot of time left, about 5 minutes. Let's take a quick super chat, actually, Jared, because we have one, and it is Abhijit Bidway, who says, is India overrated in test? Three different test champions? Well, they should have won one in the first two finals, and in this they dropped off.
They should have actually won one of the three. Like, I don't think they were overrated in tests. The end probably came a little bit too soon and a little bit more sudden than they thought for their batters and Ashwin, which caused an issue here. And they could have won one of the other ones. Yeah. I mean, they weren't massively out. They were certainly good enough team to win either of those.
All right. Quick fire on South Africa's bowling. We talked about Ngidi and how he surprised us. Janssen was brilliant in the first innings, 3 for 49, but wasn't so good with 1 for 58 in the last one. Right. And then you got Mulder overperforming, Maharaj and Markram taking a few wickets. But Kagiso Rabada was the main man. 9 for 110 in the match. 5 for 51, 4 for 59. Gets his name on the honours board once again. Crosses Alan Donald's tally, test wicket tally for South Africa. And he has the best strike rate for any bowler in test cricket with over 150 wickets. Best bowler in the game. And his career also built up to this very moment, because he's all about test cricket, right?
Yeah, I think it's a great moment for him. It's funny, he's almost had the opposite problem to Temba, where he's been so good that there are times where I'm just like, they're just going to tire him out. Like, he's just playing too much cricket, and they obviously want him to be available as much as possible. But like, you look at how much the Australian bowlers seem to get rests and Rabada just doesn't, you know, he's become, you know, the wrong kind of importance to South Africa. But on the other side, you know, what a professional he is, and he's, you know, he's overcoming a pretty big thing that happened to him recently, right? You know, he's pretty openly been embarrassed around the world, and you know, when it comes to the drugs and everything else. But he's been a fantastic bowler for a very long time. Now he can bowl to left-handers as well. Like, he's starting to catch back up again to Rabada and Cummins. To Cummins and Bumrah. Look, he's a magnificent bowler. Their bowling got them to this tournament, got them to this final.
Yeah.
Their bowling kept them in the game a couple of times throughout this. And, you know, their batting will be remembered more because it's quite an emotional chase at the end. But we're used to Rabada being good. We're not really used to their batting chasing 280 on the fourth innings.
Yeah, and here's to hoping that this is the start of something special for South Africa. We've got a super chat by Samit Khan. He says, as a Protea and Spurs and Clippers fan, it has been a great year. How brilliant is Kagiso? I think we've answered that. And is Temba's legacy now second only to Smith? Explain Markram to me. Not a great batter, but a batter of great innings. Greatest palindrome in cricket?
We were trying to work out all the different palindromes in cricket, me and Dan Norcross the other day. I'm not sure how many we ended up coming up with. Look, I mean, Smith obviously has a deeper legacy. That team was incredible. It is a weird one when you think about it, because it is very possible that had there been a World Test Championship during Smith's time, they might have won it. They were the best team for quite a big period. I know England sort of, you know, took away some of that, but they were the best team for quite some time, right? And so perhaps if they'd been there. Yeah, I mean, when it comes to legacy, I think Faf played a big part in this. I don't want to sit there and pretend that Bavuma is like some tactical genius who brought the team together, because I don't think either of us believe that, right? And we also, you know that this was an underdog team who, you know, a lot of things went right for in this game for them to be able to win. That I think Faf did a lot in changing the way that South African cricket went about things as well. And you've had multiple coaches probably rotate that you would also say are quite important. But Temba's going to be the one who brought the trophy, right?
Yes.
And eventually, one day, even Smith's legacy might fade a little bit, right? And it might be who's the person who brought the first trophy. It, you know, you don't know what the future is going to bring. So from that point of view, it's very hard. As we said with Markram before, Sammy, you might want to go back to the start. But
yeah,
I think he has technical issues, but I also think that he has everything within his technique that should allow him to be one of the best players in the world. He just doesn't have the ability. I think he just sometimes it collapses a little bit on him.
And yeah, just one thing I'd like to add before we end this podcast, Sameet, it's not just Spurs and South Africa. Throw in RCB, throw in PSG, Newcastle, Crystal Palace, Harry Kane. I mean, you've got Bologna in Italy, OKC and Indiana Pacers. They haven't won it. One of them is going to win it. And Josh Hazlewood hadn't lost an international final yet. So that has happened as well. It's been a year of trophy-ending droughts and weird stuff. And yeah, we might come live once again tomorrow to discuss Australia because we've run out of time and Jared is exhausted. But thank you so much for all of your comments and super chats. And yeah, that kind of wraps this up. Yeah, so have a good one, guys. Go revel or bask in South Africa's glory. We will see you soon enough. That's all for now. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Baram Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.